Brahma Chaloka Dipati Sahampati Katanjali Hadivaram Ayachata Santida Sata Parajaka Jatika Desetu Dhammam Anukampimam Padam.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassami. So this is the second day of the retreat. I seem to have survived it quite well. You're looking brighter. Would it be a 10-day retreat? You probably would have to wait. You would have waited until the third day, the fourth day. The process is speeded up somehow. Much brighter. But I was reflecting how much cooling we need to do. Even though this is pretty cool culture, actually. English culture is quite cool. But the mind, as you probably know by now, there's a lot of heat in there. The heat element is pretty strong. So we all love to cool down, don't we? We love. I was reading some of your forms that you filled up at the beginning of the retreat. And it was all about, I was struck how many people wrote down that they came here for some peace. Most people came here for some peace. A few said just peace and being centered. Some more kind of, a few said for meditation and learning more about meditation. I think everybody came here for meditation, really, but I was really struck how this need for peace is so strong in ourselves, and this is just a reflection of how much, you know, how much fire goes on in our mind. And we're trying to cool it down all the time. We don't always know how to do it, don't we? And fires is not just the heat element, it's also the amount of complexity that we build up in ourselves about this or that. Some very simple fact or reality just become a mountain of issues. We are easily buried under our mountain of issues, difficulties, problems. And the Dharma perspective is asking you to turn away from complexities and look at the simple facts of life. So rather than to analyze a whole train of thought, it's asking you just to look at thought and see how it behaves. What is thinking? How it behaves? How long does it last? How does it affect you? And not from an intellectual point of view, but from an intuitive knowledge, from the knowing mind, which is Ajahn Sumedho has sometimes used as intuitive knowing or intuitive knowledge, intuitive wisdom. It's a knowing that comes not from thinking, but just from seeing. From presence, and sometimes it's a little startling, because as soon as you bring the sense of presence, things become so simple that you just get lost. Something is wrong. You feel, I'm suppressing, or maybe I'm doing something wrong, because life becomes so simple when you're just present. I'm sure that during the day now you've witnessed how many times the mind go astray, how many times it moves out of this sense of presence, of knowing. And if you look deeply at the causes of this movement, it has to do with heat, with the movement, that which makes things move in the mind, agitates the mind for one thing or another. It creates a kind of turmoil. In our Dharma practice, there are many means to address this particular turmoil. Many ways, not just sitting on your cushion, but also reflections. Like this morning, we did a reflection on aging, sickness, and death, didn't we? I'm of the nature to age. I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken, to get sick, and I haven't gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die, and I haven't gone beyond dying. So this is a reflection that helps us to cool the mind down, to bring to a level where we face facts rather than a world of fantasy. I mean, when we just are facing those three facts of existence, and death in particular, I certainly remember myself, this is what brought me to the Dhamma, is the awareness that death could happen any time, that there was this illusion of a future, this illusion of planning my future, organizing my life, worrying about the future, getting excited about what's going to happen, getting depressed, all sorts of range of feelings and moods related to what the mind creates when it forgets that maybe my life could terminate any time. And we see this all around us, don't we? It's not so far away that we can forget. So sometimes people think that Buddhist practice is just sitting on one's cushion, breathing in, breathing out mindfully. But there's also a whole aspect of the practice which has to do with simple reflection like that, just which is part of your Dhamma path, reflecting on the transiency of life, reflecting on the unknown of our existence, reflecting on death, reflecting that we are fit now, but one day we might be sick. We might not be, we might not have all the privileges that we have at present, of good health, of strength in the body, of strength in the mind, of clarity of mind, and so on. So these reflections, besides cooling the mind down, also help us to appreciate our life more positively, because we can take it for granted that somehow we'll stay young forever. We'll never die. I mean, most young people don't think they ever die. And I think all of us have come through this. And if you're 20, you can't imagine that death can come. Or, you take life very seriously at 20 because it seemed like a really serious business. 30 years later, 40 years later, 50 years later, I can understand why really older people can have a good laugh at the younger people, because at the age of 70, 80, 60, 70, 80, what's a big deal, really? But you can't deny the fact that when we are 20, it is a serious matter. We've got 60 years ahead of us, and we've got to make it work for ourselves, and we've got to, we're not going to be depressed for 50 years. We've got to something has to happen. Aging process, how do we deal with that? You know, the fear of being sick. Not to mention the fear of death and all that, a part of life, an aspect of our life can bring up in terms of fears and planning, so we can, so we might not have to die. Doing everything we can to not get sick, not get old, not die. A lot of energy spent into these things. You can see in society how many gadgets are being dangled in front of us just to keep young. Botox, facelift, breast lift. Everything get lifted up now. Without any problem, just a matter of paying the bill, and you're back into looking young and healthy. Except it does look funny sometimes. Well, we go against nature. You can't just get away without paying the price somehow. So a lot of money and a lot of energy is really used just to keep the illusion that we'll never age. You know, how many time have we spent trying to find out the right color for hiding our gray hair? Not just women these days. You see men all around the place, you know, with little kind of bits of gray coming out and nice dark shade of black hair all around. I spent the last 3 years in America, and people are very much into youth there. Whether you are 20 or 85, you still have to look the part. You're young and healthy. And you do understand there, because the welfare system is very miserable there. You do have to keep young, because if you don't stay young, then you go bankrupt and you end up in the street. They don't have like a national health, however inadequate it is. You still know you're not going to be left abandoned somewhere, sick and miserable. So it's quite extraordinary, you know, when you live in the Dharma world or the world of practitioners. You're not so aware how much this is emphasized. You know, this incredible fear of aging and the amount of energy spent trying to keep lifting things up. Not to mention filling them. I saw once a program in those kind of implant, but the stuff that they put into the implant, silicones, that's right. How, you know, people have, you know, how they use silicones in trying to keep people looking young. And it was just really an eye-opener for me. I couldn't believe it. See all these Italian men coming on stage and having every bits of themselves kind of puffed up. I was shocked. I thought women did that, but I didn't realize men were into this as well. That's really baffling. And abdominals kind of puffed up. It seems ridiculous. And yet there's many people into this. You can see how much people are really just happy to enjoy the surface of things, the superficiality of life. This reflection on aging is a very potent one, because we are all aging. None of us are going to escape. You know, when I was 31, I remember I felt like 90 years old. Now that I'm much older, actually, except for the body, I feel much younger. Yeah. So the Dhamma does keep the mind young. If you want to have an investment in life to stay young, make sure you practice Dhamma. That wakefulness is really your, you know, the only thing you can really bank on, so to speak. Everything will fall apart except that brightness, radiance of mind, of mindfulness. Everything else will just go back to its elements. And we, there's enough people here over 50 to know that this is true. You know, things are definitely leaning downwards back to the earth. Or getting more podgy, kind of spreading and going down. And so, you know, if we're really vain and that's all there is to life, it's a pretty miserable program, isn't it? I mean, what a terrible thing if you're attached to the body. When the body is decaying, changing, getting sick, getting old. So this is the first reflection. And it's, remember, it's those three things are mentioned in the suttas as being the three signs that propel the Buddha onto the path of liberation. I don't know if you remember, some of you may have read that when the Buddha was a prince, he was completely protected from seeing anything like aging, sickness and death, any sign, anyone who could be aged or sick or dying. So until the age of 29, so the story goes, the Buddha actually never saw anybody old or sick or dying. And it's only at the age of 29 that he came out of his father's palace. Suddenly, as he was going through town, realized he saw the sign, he saw a person, an aging person, and asked his friend, the charioteer, Channa, "What is that? Is that going to happen to me too?" And he said, "Yes. All of us are going to age." And then he went on and saw a sick man in the street. Looked at the sick man and was absolutely shocked. And asked again, "Is that also my predicament? Is that my lot? That's what's going to happen to me too?" I said, "Yes. We get sick. Body gets sick." And then the third sign was a sign of a dead body. Again, the Buddha inquired as to whether he would die too. And his friend said, "Yes. At the end of our life, we die." And having realized this, having seen this, having witnessed that, the Buddha decided to find out the meaning of his life. What was the point of being alive if all that there was to it was to aging, getting sick and dying? If that was the only thing that awaited us, what was the point? What was the meaning? Why were we here in the first place? Just to give you a little bit of context of why these reflections is part of the teaching, because they were those three signs were the gateway for his the arising of interest in Dhamma in himself. Second one is reflection on getting sick. I'm of the nature to sicken. I have not gone beyond sickness. This is just a reflection to remind the mind that I have not gone beyond sickness. Basically, I don't know yet. I'm not liberated from sickness. and I'm not maybe liberated from my attachment or fear of sickness. I haven't not gone beyond, my mind is still not at peace with being sick. My mind hasn't come to terms with that. It still frets about, gets frightened, agitated, stressed. This reflection on the sickness, you know, I understand very well, because you know, when I was younger, I actually trained as a dancer, and so anybody who didn't look like a dancer looked pretty crippled to me. I mean, it's dreadful prejudices of a dancer, is that I was very attached to a dancer's body, whether they were man or women. So there was this very narrow kind of view on things. I had never really considered what old people until quite late in my life, until we got two old ladies who became part of the community of nuns, and we looked after them for 7, 8 years. I'll tell you more about it. And then that's when I actually met aging. You know, I suddenly realized what it meant to lose one's usefulness, to use one's control on life, to use one's mind. You know, see what happens when you have to be with somebody who is getting old. Most people in the world just are totally averse to be with old people. And I think I was very averse to be with anybody who wasn't useful looking or bright or attractive, or, you know. I had a bit of work to do when two old lady turned up, and we had to kind of look after them day and night. Continuing the reflection on sickness, this is such an enormous fact in our life that we dread being sick. It's really interesting, because we haven't reflected that the body is prone to sickness. The body is not free from sickness. We have all sorts of things going on, you know. We don't see the body very much as a limited thing. I certainly didn't see the body as a limited thing. I think I could do anything with my body. You know, I didn't ever looked at it as a limit. Yeah. Never frightened me, you know. Never felt fear with the body, particularly, or conscious. I didn't feel fear. I wasn't conscious of fears with the body, you know, until I started meditating and realized this body is there's a lot of fear in there, and a lot of the fear to die, the fear to disappear, the fear to change. The fear so much is invested in trying to keep the body healthy, which is a good thing. I mean, this is our instrument after all. We do have to keep it in strong enough to, for example, to practice. I mean, if we didn't have a good back and good knees and good health to a certain degree, we wouldn't be able to sit here and go through what we have to go through when we do intensive practice like this. But a lot of our mind is also extremely busy with the body. And this is what you need to see in the Dhamma. You need to see the busyness of the mind around the desire to keep the body healthy. When I started meditating and saw the amount of worrying there was in myself, which was shared by most people I met, the amount of anxiety. With the body, we have a very kind of strange relationship to it. Because, even though we want to stay healthy and strong and useful and fairly comfortable in the body, we also, you know, it's also very much the receiver of all our negativity and stress. There is a kind of conflictual kind of relationship with our body. We want to punish it when we don't feel very good. Somebody says diet will be good. We maybe think it's a good idea, but you know, we rather think about anything but doing a diet that may help you to sustain the body healthy. Or certain habits may not be so good for the body, like smoking, drinking, constantly worrying, stressing oneself, not being with the body, not acknowledging the body. That in itself is quite stressful. You know, we can spend so much time caught into mental activities, not paying much attention to how it affects us, how it influences this whole physical experience. Yeah. So this reflection of the nature to sicken, I've not gone beyond sickness, it reminds you, if we don't take care of our body and know that the body is also dependent on the mind and the mind is dependent on the body, they all have an interrelationship, they all affect each other. Sometimes the body affects the mind, sometimes the mind affects the body. You know, if the understanding is not there, then we can easily damage the body, you know, by overriding the signals that it sends. You know, body is very good kind of gauge. Mm-hmm. Gives you every signal you need to know about your mind, you know, if you know how to read them. And I know for myself, quite often I have dismissed them. You know, through the strength of the mind, sometimes you just override the physical signals. You know? So it's important that you don't indulge, you know, into pampering the body endlessly. But it's more a question of understanding how it works. Like if you're obsessed about the body, you're actually going to make your body sick. That's not going to help it. Because obsession is the outcome of worry. That's not going to help much. So we need to consider, you know, that when one gets sick, it's not unnatural. The body does get sick. People think that if you thought the right thought all the time, then you will never get ill. We're still at the mercy of bugs and at the mercy of weaknesses in the body, at the mercy of organs failing. Not because you've been thinking a certain way necessarily. Of course, that will affect the rest of the body too, if you think in a negative way for too long. Sometimes just nature is like that. The body is part of nature, you know. Trees fall down, leaves fall up every year. Eventually, you can see an old tree eventually falls down. And it hasn't been depressed particularly. It hasn't suffered from stress or mismanagement. It just is nature. At some point it just goes, you know. It's the same thing for us, you know. Sometimes we do create the conditions for aging more rapidly, and sometimes we just nature, we just age. I still remember going to visit somebody called Feroz Mehta, who was a very famous, quite well famous teacher in London. He was Indian and a great scholar. And I visited him when he was 92. He had been a brilliant scholar, a brilliant mind, and even though I never heard him speak, but I read some of his books, and it was just extraordinary. the way that his mind reflected on the interface of religions and various philosophies and so on. In 92, he was still there. You could see his whole being was still there. His body was very, very frail. But he wasn't able to jump around and bounce around and be the charming, fierce metta that he probably had been. He was just quite slow and quite still and not very exciting particularly. But his presence was extraordinary. His being was just very powerful. That was kind of cooling, if anything. And you can see from, even though we want to cool down, we're still totally addicted to excitement. Something like, something is going to happen, something new. Maybe I get younger. Maybe I'll never get sick. Maybe I won't die. Maybe I'm an immortal. Maybe if I do the five Tibetans, as they say, I might actually be immortal. Some of you know the five Tibetans. They are a set of exercises kind of that are described by this person who went to this very remote secret land in the Himalayas where people never age and never die. So maybe if I do the five Tibetans long enough, I might actually reverse. Okay, I can imagine what it must be like to go back to the age of teenager's time. 17. Can you remember? Not just ourselves, but our relationship to our parents. Have to go through this again. What a hell run that would be. Not to mention getting married and children and so on. All the dreams we have at the age of 20, 21, 22, you know, and then at the age of 30, most of us, I'm sure, feel pretty kind of aged already. So, sickness is not a personal problem. You don't need to feel bad about being ill. The Buddha says we are of the nature to get sick, and we haven't gone beyond sickness if we haven't been ill yet. And this again is a cause for appreciation of our good health and the people who are in good health, feeling a sense of mudita, appreciation. So instead of complaining about, oh, I don't have the right food and I don't have the right conditions and I don't have the right job to be healthy and I don't have, you know, and complaining, then you're just, that complaining mind will make you sick. But if you just appreciate what is given at each moment, then that's what can sustain, if not the health of the body, at least the health of the mind. So you won't end up on your deathbed thinking that nothing is going to happen to you. Everybody is saying, oh, she looks so good today, whilst everybody knows she's dying, pretending. You look so cheerful, Mary. Wonderful to see you. And everybody in the room next door is crying, weeping, you know, grieving already. Mary's death. And Mary thinks she's going to live, you know. Totally unprepared for this, the next stage, the next reflection. I'm of the nature to die. I have not gone beyond dying. We're still here, aren't we? As Ram Dass' book is called, his latest book. Some of you know Ram Dass, don't you? Any baby boomers here? 60s, no? No? But I'm sure you still know Ram Dass. And his latest book was I'm Still Here, Still Here. And he had a stroke himself. You know, even though he used to go scuba diving and forgot his blood pressure pills and so on, and he got a stroke. So now he's learning from his stroke. And there was a very lovely documentary films about his life, in which we can see him in his wheelchair going around and then talking about his learning through this sickness, talking about how he's using this sickness to continue to walk along his journey. You know, so it's very touching, very moving. When are we going to die? Today? Tomorrow? 100 years? 50 years? It's unpredictable, isn't it? Even though we do have a sense that something can happen tomorrow, somehow. And hopefully we'll live as long as we can live, you know, as long as we, this life can last. But not to take it for granted. I know personally myself this reflection on death, even though I wasn't a Buddhist particularly, or I wasn't, you know, interested in Buddhism at the time personally, I still remember, maybe because I was in a vulnerable state, or maybe I was open, I was searching, I was looking for, find a meaning for my life and so on. I remember being struck one day. There was a young actor, a British young actor, who actually died of a heart attack at the age of 31 or something like that. And I liked this actor very much. And remember thinking, oh, I was quite, really being totally shocked by it. And this news actually made me realize that death could come any time. And that's when I felt very strongly that I really needed to sort myself out, quote unquote, you know. I needed to really do something to really live my life as I wished, so that the strongest perception was that, so when I die, then I don't have any regret. At the time I felt I wanted to live in a way that I didn't have to regret my life. And also, this reflection on death brought an immediate sense of presence, immediately brought me down to reality. It was just extraordinary, because, as I said, never done a reflection on death before. Never really trained myself to do that. But I was aware that just bringing death into my mind brought instant clear seeing. Like if I had any doubts about things, you know, which option to take, what to do, and how my mind would proliferate about this and this and this and that, and say, what if I die tomorrow, what would I like to do? It's just amazing, this very powerful effect it had on me. I don't use it as much now. I mean, it's part of our life, you could say. It's an ongoing reflection in our daily life. But at the time it was very striking, because it was so much out of the ordinary to see the result of just bringing up death, and my whole body would just relax and find be very at peace with things. So it was a great cooling factor. And I've seen many people dying in my life here since I've been a nun. And I've been blessed with seeing most wonderful people dying in a most wonderful way, which is something that I cherish, because when it happens to me, then I can bring up into my mind this amazing kind of experience of being with people right to the end. I still remember several people came actually to die at the monastery, but there was one in particular. She was a Thai lady, and she'd had cancer 3 years before she died, and she was cured after, you know, doing a pilgrimage in Thailand, spending 6 months with us at Chittagong, ordaining temporary at Chittagong. And then 3 years later, she had been diagnosed with liver cancer, and she'd seen enough liver cancer for her to know that it was better for her to prepare herself to die. Even though since then, I knew a man who's passed away now, who at the age of 80 had liver cancer, managed to continue traveling the world, sort of speaking at conferences, getting remarried with a 35-year-old, and have a child. So it is unpredictable. You can see our karma is unpredictable. But this person in particular felt that was time for her, whatever. She was a very good Dhamma practitioner. So she wasn't frightened by death. You know, she'd seen a lot of death in her life because she was also working as a volunteer in a hospital. And so she came, and it was extraordinary just to be with her the last 6 weeks of her life. And to see the last minute, you know, how she was just so bright and alive. She had didn't have a lot of pain even. We spent a lot of time just around her. We sat in her room, monks and nuns sat in her room, we did some chanting. And then about 5 minutes before she died, maybe 10 minutes, let's say, she had a bag of sweets. She sort of said, oh, let's share all these sweets. This is my last sensual enjoyment on this earth. And so she shared out all the sweets. And then 5 minutes later, she got up. She sat up, and then she went back down, and she died. And she was very bright, I mean, very kind of, even chirpy. It was a kind of energy of radiance and brightness, quite extraordinary. And we had also a man who came to die here, and he was interested in talking about metta, having a metta kind of seminar with us. And so he was interested in leading this metta seminar, and the next day he died. We did a seminar together, a little sort of session on studying various texts and reflection on metta. The next morning he died. He was himself a Dhamma teacher who had been teaching Dhamma for many years, and he came here and wanted to die at the monastery. So I've been blessed with this, witnessing this quite inspiring endings. And I've also seen people not dying so well. It is, our life is also a preparation for death, isn't it? It is really a preparation to, we live well so we can die well. They go together. Because if we really put all our good energy into living wholeheartedly this life, without holding back, without being selfish, without being caught into fear, and then we find that probably we'll die much more peacefully. That's what I noticed, when people have had a good life, they tend to die much more at peace with themselves. This reflection on dying, I'm of the nature to die, I'm not gone beyond dying. And again, it's a way of appreciating our life right now. When we think of death, instead of getting depressed and miserable and demanding and needy, and then we can just appreciate this moment as a very precious moment, this life as a precious life, this opportunity to learn as a precious opportunity, this moment of of the feeling of failure, the feeling of all the things, the mistake we make in life. Then we can get really heated up about the mistakes we make, the fact that we don't get it right all the time. So our mind can be very righteous, saying, you should have done it this way, and you should have, And then we feel guilty, and then we feel bad, and then, we spiral down into a hell realm very quickly. So, but then you reflect, I may die tomorrow. What is important right now? What is meaningful? Part of these three aspects, of these three points of aging, sickness and death, is an aspect of forgiveness. Just being able to forgive oneself for being stupid. Forgive oneself for, forgetting. To be aware. Forgive oneself for being misunderstood. Getting upset about it. So you can see it's a rich forum, isn't it? That aspect of not holding on to old grudges. Tomorrow we may end. Not holding on to old fears, to old projection that we have onto each other, or perceptions, you know, views, strong ideas we have about ourselves, about others, and so on. It's so important to develop that lightness, which is part of letting go. It's very hard, though. I mean, I understand, very hard for all of us. We need many skills to let go. It's not just sitting on one's cushion. We need to talk to ourselves too. Ajahn Chah used to say to his students, you know, that he would encourage talking to oneself, like you talk to a friend. So it's not just sitting, but also you can, you know, reading the suttas, reflecting on the teachings, encouraging oneself. You know, because the program of ignorance is bent on destruction. Just loves, you know, to kind of demolish all the good work that you do. If any of you have come across the poems of the enlightened monks and the enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha, you can see it's all about Mara, which constantly comes. Even though they're enlightened, Mara still has the guts to come and tell them, what are you doing here, sister? I mean, you could be having such a fun in life. You could have a husband and make lots of merits and have fun and enjoy all the sensual pleasures of the world instead of looking gaunt and miserable and so on. And the nuns say, I know you, Mara. I've seen the limitation of sense pleasure. Thank you very much. It's my interpretation. I wish I could remember all these stories to tell you those stories. Some of them are quite wonderful. You can see there was already this seed of feminist in them. So one of them is talking about freed from husband, freed from pestle and mortar. At last, I've seen through the veil of delusion. No. It's quite funny. Can relate to that, some people, I'm sure. This destructive tendencies we need to know and to use. I really encourage you to use, you know, any skillful means that help you. We are here to develop our own wisdom. Remember that even though I've been taught for many years by Ajahn Sumedho, I've been taught by, you know, certain other teachers from other traditions, even though I'm still recognizing that I need to know what works for me. And I need to know what is helpful for myself. We all need to discover that. There's not one miracle technique that's going to do it all. We have enormous wealth of means. So ask yourself, what is it that, what would help me now? I'm giving you some hints, like reflecting on sickness, aging, and death. That's a very good reflection. Maybe sometime when we get heavy on ourselves, maybe we need to learn how to relax and just have a nice cup of tea, stroking the cats. We don't have to sort of get a kind of jhana program of enlightenment to feel okay about life and about ourselves. But within the realm of skillful means, you know, we also have to understand what is not helpful, what is unskillful means. We need to know that the goal, if we lose sight of the goal of practice, then we can easily get lost. Just like aging, sickness, and death, we need to remind ourselves again and again, what is the purpose of this journey? What is the purpose of my life? What is the purpose of my practice? Remember, it's very simple, just a simple question. What is the purpose of my practice? We can even cling to practice so desperately that we actually lose it. You know, we lose the path just by clinging to the practice. Cling to the idea of meditator. Somebody was sharing with me today, you know, that this person wanting a certain brightness. And even just that desire to have something is already little wall between you and that, the freedom of the mind, you know, peace. That's the little wall you create. So that's why you may have read in many stories, many books, that enlightenment happens sometime just at the most unexpected moment. You know, I mean, I think one of the, if I remember correctly, the story of one enlightened nun, she, you know, she pulled the water and she switched off the wick of her lamp and she was enlightened. It wasn't like she was kind of straining herself and feeling it's coming. Coming. You know, with big bang and flashing lights and fireworks and all that sort of things. It was just, you know, she emptied her jug, switched the light off, and bang, there it was. Ananda, who was the cousin of the Buddha, he was the only one that wasn't enlightened in, whilst he was meditating amongst his monks. He'd been told that before the first council, Ananda had been reproved by his fellow monks, because one of the reasons why he'd been sort of criticized, it was because he had allowed the nuns in the order. And he wasn't enlightened yet. It was only the last stage. He wasn't an arahant yet. So the elders gave him a real hard time and say, you won't be part of the council until you're enlightened. So he spent the whole night practicing, meditating, kind of really intensively through the night, walking back and forth and sitting and walking and sitting and walking, and at the end he got completely discouraged and felt he was not going anywhere. And as he was just about, so the story goes, just about going to lie down, his elbows touched the mattress, whatever, the mats, and he got enlightened when he'd given Lord up. So you see, that's why I say to you, don't expect anything. The whole program, isn't it, for our conditioning, which is always into wanting something, wanting some proofs. I will do it only if it works. If it doesn't work, the hell with it, I don't want it. And I want proofs now, not tomorrow, you know, immediate. So here we are. I think I end on that. Remember this reflection on I'm of the nature to age, I have not gone beyond aging. I am of the nature to sicken, I have not gone beyond sickness. I am of the nature to die, I have not gone beyond dying. And the last part of the reflection, we haven't even gone into this, but all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. So that's another big one to consider, isn't it? And that's the truth. Everything will be separated from us. That means you can enjoy fully what is here with you now. You know, it will go one day. So don't start moaning about when it will go and then being miserable whilst it's present with you. When we do that a lot, don't we? We spoil our joy by thinking too much about the future and forgetting that things change. So this reflection is a way of training. We do train the mind. I know training has a horrible connotation for some people. It used sometimes, for me, I used to dislike this word training, because it seemed like I was in the military, training to be a good soldier. But it is. I mean, we have to be quite realistic about this. It is a training, which is not, you know, we don't have to be militaristic about it, but it's a compassionate training, yeah. Helping the mind. It's like your mind is not what you are, but you still have to live with it, so you have to kindly kind of guide it and give it some pointers, give it some reference points, some guidelines to help the energy going flow in the right directions. Tantra used to say, the mind is like a cobra. It's as deadly as a cobra. But if you don't touch it, a cobra doesn't bother you. Yes, I've seen cobras. If you don't step on their toes, they leave you alone. I've seen big ones too. So another aspect, just to finish, I just want you to know that we fear, because the fear manifests as this feeling of being completely alone, abandoned, and we're not cared for. Actually, a lot of things are helping us right now. Many, many things are helping us. Many good forces are helping us. We just need to turn towards them, and the Buddha Dhamma is one of them. You know, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, the three refuges, is one of those very compassionate energy that we are cultivating in ourselves and tuning in as well. So I'll end on this note. We'll do the chant on page 35. This is a chant on sharing blessings. It's like a Buddhist prayer, you could say. It's very complete. If you read it in spare time, it's a very beautiful chant, and it really covers most of our wishes. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may their highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly and different or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attend the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge, and surpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. So, this is the end of the day. I just want to say that there will be a session of question and answers tomorrow, and this is a ball in which you can write your questions and leave them there. So, tomorrow we meet again here at 5:30, and as you go to prepare yourself to go to sleep now, remember to send yourself some good wishes, kind wishes, to develop this, continuing your practice of mindfulness in the lying posture. And also, I just want to impress that on your mind that, you know, your practice doesn't stop at the meditation hall. You know, that to really the in-between periods are very, very important too, right? So that you don't kind of forget everything, or at least mindfulness. You can forget everything, but not mindfulness. Yes? As you walk in the through the corridors, going to the kitchen, having a drink, you know, moving around the dormitories and so on, you know, you still continue that mindfulness practice of walking, knowing you're walking, drinking, you know you're drinking, you know, just being aware of the body moving, the movement of your legs as you walk. And as you lie down, you can, you know, sweep the body with this quality of awareness. Yeah? And that usually facilitates good sleep. Yeah. And then the intention of getting up, that also makes it a lot easier to get up. That's my experience, you know, just saying to yourself, programming yourself, I will get up at this time. You find that it's actually, for some reason, the mind is very suggestible, you know. It's quite sensitive, so you just have to say something and you register it, you know. So, register metta, kindness, too. Okay. We'll finish by closing with a closing homage. Arahaṁ sammā sambuddho bhagavā, the Lord, the perfectly enlightened and blessed one, buddhaṁ bhagavantaṁ abhivātemi, I render homage to the Buddha, the blessed one. Sawakato Bhagavata Dhammo, the teaching so completely explained by him, Dhammam Namasami, I bow to the Dhamma. Supatipanno Bhagavato Sawaka Sangho, the blessed ones, disciples who have practiced well, Sangha Namami, I bow to the Sangha.